pension for too long. Labor was no exception to that rule. After 3.5 hours of pushing, my son finally emerged, weighing 9 pounds, 7 ounces. Half of that weight was in his head. My sister is a pediatrician and has attended hundreds of deliveries. She kindly did not tell me until much later that mine was one of the hardest she had ever witnessed. It was all worth it when my son was pronounced healthy, and the nausea that I had felt for 9 straight months vanished within an hour. The worst was over. The next morning, I got out of bed in my hospital room, took one step, and fell to the floor. Apparently, I had yanked my leg back so hard during labor that I had pulled a tendon. I was on crutches for a week. Being unable to stand added a degree of difficulty to my first week of motherhood, but also provided one unforeseen benefit. Dave became the primary caregiver for our newborn. Dave had to get up when the baby cried, bring him to me to be fed, change him, and then get him back to sleep. Normally, the mother becomes the instant baby care expert. In our case, Dave taught me how to change a diaper when our son was 8 days old. If Dave and I had planned this, we would have been geniuses. But we didn't, and we aren't. In fact, we should have planned a lot more. When I was 6 months pregnant, a PhD candidate interviewed me by phone for her dissertation on working couples. She began by asking, "How do you do it all?" I said, "I don't. I don't even have a child," and suggested that she interview someone who actually did. She said, "You're just a few months away from having a baby, so surely you and your husband have thought about who is going to pick up your child if he is sick at school, who is going to arrange for childcare, and so on." I couldn't answer a single one of her questions. By the end of the call, I was in full panic, overwhelmed by how truly unprepared Dave and I were to handle these responsibilities. As soon as Dave walked in the door that night, I pounced. "Oh my God," I said. "We are just a few months away from having a baby, and we have never talked about any of this." Dave looked at me like I was crazy. "What?" he said. "This is all we talk about." In dissecting this discrepancy, Dave and I figured out that we had spent a lot of time talking about how we would do things, but almost always in the abstract. So Dave was right that we had discussed parenthood often, and I was right that the discussion had not been that practical. Part of the problem was that our inexperience made it hard even to know what specifics to cover. We had very little idea what we were in for. I also think that we were in denial about the tremendous shift in our lives that was rapidly approaching. Dave and I were not even working in the same city when I got pregnant. Although, just to be clear, we were in the same place when I got pregnant. Dave had founded a company, Launch Media, in LA, and sold it to Yahoo years earlier. Yahoo's headquarters were in Northern California, where I lived and worked, but Dave's team remained in Los Angeles, where he lived and worked. When we started dating, we decided to base our life together in the Bay Area. So Dave began commuting, typically spending Monday through Thursday in Southern California, and then flying north to spend weekends with me. This pattern continued even after we were married. After the birth of our son, Dave began flying back and forth several times a week. It was great that we had the ability for him to commute, but it was far from ideal. Even though he was making an exhausting effort to be with me and our baby, he was still gone a lot. Since I was with the baby full-time, the great majority of childcare fell to me. The division of labor felt uneven and strained our marriage. We hired a nanny, but she couldn't solve all our problems. The emotional support and shared experience that a spouse provides cannot be bought. After a few short months of parenthood, we had already fallen into traditional, lopsided gender roles. We were not unique. In the last 30 years, women have made more progress in the workforce than in the home. According to the most recent analysis, When a husband and wife both are employed full-time, the mother does 40% more childcare and about 30% more housework than the father. A 2009 survey found that only 9% of people in dual-earner marriages said that they shared housework, childcare, and breadwinning evenly. So while men are taking on more household responsibilities, this increase is happening very slowly, and we are still far from parity. Perhaps unsurprisingly, same-sex couples divide household tasks much more evenly. Public policy reinforces this gender bias. The U.S. Census Bureau considers mothers the designated parent, even when both parents are present in the home. When mothers care for their children, it's parenting. But when fathers care for their children, the government deems it a child care arrangement. I have even heard a few men say that they are heading home to babysit for their children. I have never heard a woman refer to taking care of her own children as babysitting. A friend of mine ran a team-building exercise during a company retreat where people were asked to fill in their hobbies. Half of the men in the group listed their children as hobbies. A hobby? For most mothers, kids are not a hobby. Showering is a hobby. My friends Katie and Scott Middick flip this pattern. Katie and Scott are both Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who work full-time. About a year ago, Scott traveled to the East Coast for work. He was starting a late morning meeting when his phone rang. His team only heard one side of the conversation. A sandwich, carrot sticks, a cut-up apple, pretzels, and a cookie, Scott said. He hung up smiling and explained that his wife was asking what she should put in the kids' lunchboxes. Everyone laughed. A few months later, Scott was back east with the same work colleagues. They were in a cab late that morning when Scott's phone rang. His team listened in disbelief as he patiently repeated the lunch list all over again. A sandwich, carrot sticks, a cut-up apple, pretzels, and a cookie. When Scott tells this story, it's sweet and funny. But take this same story and switch the genders, and it loses its charm. That's just reality for most couples. Scott and Katie buck expectations with their division of household duties. There's an epilogue to their story. Scott went on a third trip and discovered that Katie forgot to make the kids' lunches altogether. She realized her slip-up mid-morning and solved the problem by having a pizza delivered to the school cafeteria. Their kids were thrilled, but Scott was not. Now when he travels, he packs lunches in advance and leaves notes with specific instructions for his wife. There may be an evolutionary basis for one parent knowing better what to put in a child's lunch. Women who breastfeed are arguably baby's first lunchbox. But even if mothers are more naturally inclined toward nurturing, fathers can match that skill with knowledge and effort. If women want to succeed more at work, and if men want to succeed more at home, these expectations have to be challenged. As Gloria Steinem once observed, it's not about biology, but about consciousness. We overcome biology with consciousness in other areas. For example, storing large amounts of fat was necessary to survive when food was scarce, so we evolved to crave it and consume it when it's available. But in this era of plenty, we no longer need large amounts of fuel in reserve, so instead of simply giving in to this inclination, we exercise and limit caloric intake. We use willpower to combat biology, or at least we try. So even if mother knows best is rooted in biology, it need not be written in stone. A willing mother and a willing father are all it requires. Yes, someone needs to remember what goes into the lunchbox, but as Katie will attest, it does not have to be mom. As women must be more empowered at work, men must be more empowered at home. I have seen so many women inadvertently discourage their husbands from doing their share by being too controlling or critical. Social scientists call this maternal gatekeeping, which is a fancy term for, "Oh my God, that's not the way you do it. Just move aside and let me." When it comes to children, fathers often take their cues from mothers. This gives a mother great power to encourage or impede the father's involvement. If she acts as a gatekeeper mother and is reluctant to hand over responsibility, or worse, questions the father's efforts, he does less. Whenever a married woman asks me for advice on co-parenting with a husband, I tell her to let him put the diaper on the baby any way he wants, as long as he's doing it himself. And if he gets up to deal with the diaper before being asked, she should smile, even if he puts that diaper on the baby's head. Over time, if he does things his way, he'll find the correct end. But if he's forced to do things her way, pretty soon she'll be doing them herself. Anyone who wants her mate to be a true partner must treat him as an equal and equally capable partner. And if that's not reason enough, bear in mind that a study found that wives who engage in gatekeeping behaviors do 5 more hours of family work per week than wives who take a more collaborative approach. Another common and counterproductive dynamic occurs when women assign or suggest tasks to their partners. She is delegating, and that's a step in the right direction. But sharing responsibility should mean sharing responsibility. Each partner needs to be in charge of specific activities, or it becomes too easy for one to feel like he's doing a favor instead of doing his part. Like many pieces of advice, letting a partner take responsibility and do his share in his own way is easy to say and hard to do. My brother David and sister-in-law Amy were very aware of this tension when they first became parents. "There were many times when our daughter was more easily consoled by me," Amy said. "It's really hard to listen to your baby cry while your struggling husband with no breasts tries desperately and sometimes awkwardly to comfort her." David was insistent that rather than handing the baby to me when she was crying, we allow him to comfort her even if it took longer. It was harder in the short run, but it absolutely paid off when our daughter learned that Daddy could take care of her as well as Mommy. I truly believe that the single most important career decision that a woman makes is whether she will have a life partner and who that partner is. I don't know of one woman in a leadership position whose life partner is not fully, and I mean fully, supportive of her career. No exceptions. And contrary to the popular notion that only unmarried women can make it to the top, the majority of the most successful female business leaders have partners. Of the 28 women who have served as CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, 26 were married, 1 was divorced, and only 1 had never married. Many of these CEOs said they could not have succeeded without the support of their husbands, helping with the children, the household chores, and showing a willingness to move. Not surprisingly, a lack of spousal support can have the opposite effect on a career. In a 2007 study of well-educated professional women who had left the paid workforce, 60% cited their husbands as a critical factor in their decision. These women specifically listed their husbands' lack of participation in childcare and other domestic tasks and the expectation that wives should be the ones to cut back on employment as reasons for quitting. No wonder when asked at a conference what men could do to help advance women's leadership, Harvard Business School professor Rosabeth Moss Cantor answered, "The laundry." Tasks like laundry, food shopping, cleaning, and cooking are mundane and mandatory. Typically, these tasks fall to women. In January 2012, I received a letter from Ruth Chang, a doctor with 2 young children who had seen my TED Talk. She had been offered a new job overseeing 75 doctors in 5 medical clinics. Her first instinct was to say no out of concern that she could not handle the expanded responsibility in addition to taking care of her family. But then she wavered, and in that moment, Dr. Chang wrote me, "I heard your voice saying, sit at the table." And I knew I had to accept the promotion. So that evening, I told my husband I was taking the job, and then handed him the grocery list. Sharing the burden of the mundane can make all the difference. My career and marriage are inextricably intertwined. During that first year Dave and I were parents, it became clear that balancing two careers and two cities was not adding up to one happy family. We needed to make some changes. But what? I loved my job at Google, and he felt enormously loyal to his team in LA. We struggled through the commuting for another long year of marital less than bliss. By then, Dave was ready to leave Yahoo. He limited his job search to the San Francisco area, which was a sacrifice on his part, since more of his professional interests and contacts were in LA. He eventually became CEO of SurveyMonkey and was able to move the company headquarters from Portland to the Bay Area. Once we were in the same city, it still took us some time to figure out how to coordinate our work schedules. Even though Dave and I are extraordinarily fortunate and can afford exceptional childcare, there are still difficult and painful decisions about how much time our jobs require us to be away from our family, and who will pick up the slack. We sit down at the beginning of every week and figure out which one of us will drive our children to school each day. We both try to be home for dinner as many nights as we can. At dinner, we go around the table and share the best and worst event from our day. I refrain from saying so, but my best is usually being home for dinner in the first place. If one of us is scheduled to be away, the other almost always arranges to be home. On weekends, I try to focus completely on my kids. Although I have been known to sneak off a few emails from the bathroom of the local soccer field. Like all marriages, ours is a work in progress. Dave and I have had our share of bumps on our path to achieving a roughly 50-50 split. After a lot of effort and seemingly endless discussion, we are partners, not just in what we do, but in who is in charge. Each of us makes sure that things that need to get done do indeed get done. Our division of household chores is actually pretty traditional. Dave pays bills, handles our finances, provides tech support. I schedule the kids' activities, make sure there is food in the fridge, plan the birthday parties. Sometimes I'm bothered by this classic gender division of labor. Am I perpetuating stereotypes by falling into these patterns? But I would rather plan a Dora the Explorer party than pay an insurance bill. And since Dave feels the exact opposite, this arrangement works for us. It takes continual communication, honesty, and a lot of forgiveness to maintain a rickety balance. We are never at 50-50 at any given moment. Perfect equality is hard to define or sustain. But we allow the pendulum to swing back and forth between us. In the coming years, our balancing act may get harder. Our children are still young and go to sleep early, which gives me plenty of time to work at night and even to watch what Dave considers to be truly bad TV. As the kids get older, we will have to adjust. Many of my friends have told me that teenage children require more time from their parents. Every stage of life has its challenges. Fortunately, I have Dave to figure it out with me. He's the best partner I could imagine. Even though he's wrong about my TV shows being bad. Having a true partner like Dave is still far too rare. While we expect women to be nurturing, we don't have the same expectations of men. My brother David once told me about a colleague who bragged about playing soccer the afternoon that his first child was born. To David's credit, instead of nodding and smiling, he spoke up and explained that he didn't think that was either cool or impressive. This opinion needs to be voiced loudly and repeatedly on soccer fields, in workplaces, and in homes. My brother had a wonderful role model in my father, who was an engaged and active parent. Like most men of his generation, my father did very little domestic work, but unlike most men of his generation, he was happy to change diapers and give baths. He was home for dinner every night, since his ophthalmology practice required no travel and involved few emergencies. He coached my brother's and sister's sports teams, and would have happily coached mine if I had been the slightest bit coordinated. He helped me with my homework regularly, and was my most enthusiastic fan when I participated in oratory contests. Studies from around the world have concluded that children benefit greatly from paternal involvement. Research over the last 40 years has consistently found that in comparison to children with less involved fathers, children with involved and loving fathers have higher levels of psychological well-being and better cognitive abilities. When fathers provide even just routine childcare, children have higher levels of educational and economic achievement and lower delinquency rates. Their children even tend to be more empathetic and socially competent. These findings hold true for children from all socioeconomic backgrounds, whether or not the mother is highly involved. We all need to encourage men to lean into their families. Unfortunately, traditional gender roles are reinforced not just by individuals, but also by employment policies. Most companies in the United States offer more time off for maternity than paternity leave, and men take far fewer extended breaks from work for family reasons. Our laws support this double standard. In the United States, only 5 states provide any income replacement for the care of a new baby, which is a large problem in and of itself. In 3 of these states, this benefit is only offered to mothers and is characterized as a pregnancy disability benefit. Only 2 states offer a paid family leave benefit that fathers can use. In general, fathers do not take much time off for a new child. A survey of fathers in the corporate sector found that the vast majority took off 1 week or less when their partners gave birth, hardly enough time to start out as an equal parent. I'm proud that even before I arrived, Facebook offered equal time for maternity and paternity leave. When family-friendly benefits like paternity leave or reduced work hours are offered, both male and female employees often worry that if they take advantage of these programs, they will be seen as uncommitted to their jobs. And for good reason. Employees who use these benefits often face steep penalties, ranging from substantial pay cuts to lost promotions to marginalization. Both men and women can be penalized at work for prioritizing family, but men may pay an even higher price. When male employees take a leave of absence or just leave work early to care for a sick child, they can face negative consequences that range from being teased to receiving lower performance ratings to reducing their chance for a raise or promotion. Fathers who want to drop out of the workforce entirely and devote themselves to childcare can face extremely negative social pressure. Currently, fathers make up less than 4% of parents who work full-time inside the home, and many report that it can be very isolating. My friend Peter Noon spent several years as a stay-at-home father and found that while people claimed to respect his choice, he did not feel welcomed into the social circles in his neighborhood. As a man at the playground, or in the not-so-tactfully named mommy and me classes, strangers viewed him with a certain amount of distrust. The friendly and easy connections that the women made were not extended to him. Time and again, he was reminded that he was outside the norm. Gender-specific expectations remain self-fulfilling. The belief that mothers are more committed to family than to work penalizes women, because employers assume they won't live up to expectations of professional dedication. The reverse is true for men, who are expected to put their careers first. We judge men primarily by their professional success and send them a clear message that personal achievements are insufficient for them to be valued or feel fulfilled. This mindset leads to a grown man bragging on the soccer field that he left his postpartum wife and newborn at the hospital to go kick a ball. Making gender matters even worse, men's success is viewed not just in absolute terms, but often in comparison to their wives. The image of a happy couple still includes a husband who is more professionally successful than the wife. If the reverse occurs, it's perceived as threatening to the marriage. People frequently pull me aside to ask sympathetically, "How is Dave? Is he okay with, you know, all your success?" Dave is far more self-confident than I am, and given his own professional success, these comments are easy for him to brush off. More and more men will have to do the same since almost 30% of U.S. working wives now out-earn their husbands. As that number continues to grow, I hope the whispering stops. Dave and I can laugh off concerns about his supposedly fragile ego, but for many women, this is no laughing matter. Women face enough barriers to professional success. If they also have to worry that they will upset their husbands by succeeding, how can we hope to live in an equal world? When looking for a life partner, my advice to women is date all of them. The bad boys, the cool boys, the commitment-phobic boys, the crazy boys. But do not marry them. The things that make the bad boys sexy do not make them good husbands. When it comes time to settle down, find someone who wants an equal partner. Someone who thinks women should be smart, opinionated, and ambitious. Someone who values fairness and expects, or even better, wants to do his share in the home. These men exist, and trust me, over time, nothing is sexier. If you don't believe me, check out a fabulous little book called Porn for Women. One page shows a man cleaning a kitchen while insisting, "I like to get to these things before I have to be asked." Another man gets out of bed in the middle of the night wondering, "Is that the baby? I'll get her." Christina Salen, the CFO of Etsy, told me that when she was dating, she wanted to see how much a boyfriend would support her career. So she devised a test. She would break a date at the last minute, claiming there was a professional conflict, and see how the guy would react. If he understood and simply rescheduled, she would go out with him again. When Christina wanted to take a relationship to the next level, she gave him another test. While working in emerging markets in the late 1990s, she would invite the guy to visit her for the weekend in Sao Paulo. It was a great way to find out if he was willing to fit his schedule around hers. The trials paid off. She found her Mr. Right, and they have been happily married for 14 years. Not only is her husband, Daniel, completely supportive of her career, he's also the primary caregiver for their two children. Even after finding the right guy or gal, no one comes fully formed. I learned from my mother to be careful about role definition in the beginning of a relationship. Even though my mother did most of the household work, my father always vacuumed the floor after dinner. She never had to persuade him to do this chore. It was simply his job from day one. At the start of a romance, it's tempting for a woman to show a more classic, girlfriendy side by volunteering to cook meals and take care of errands. And suddenly, we're back in 1955. If a relationship begins in an unequal place, it is likely to get more unbalanced when and if children are added to the equation. Instead, use the beginning of a relationship to establish the division of labor, just as Nora Ephron's dialogue in When Harry Met Sally reminds us. "Harry, you take someone to the airport, it's clearly the beginning of the relationship. That's why I have never taken anyone to the airport at the beginning of a relationship." Sally: "Why?" Harry: "Because eventually things move on and you don't take someone to the airport, and I never wanted anyone to say to me, 'How come you never take me to the airport anymore?'" If you want a 50-50 partnership, establish that pattern at the outset. A few years ago, Mark Zuckerberg and his partner, now wife, Priscilla Chan, made a donation to improve the Newark, New Jersey public school system and needed someone to run their foundation. I recommended Jen Holleran, who had deep knowledge and experience in school reform. She also had 14-month-old twins and had cut her hours by two-thirds since their birth. Her husband, Andy, is a child psychiatrist who was involved with raising the kids when he was home. But once Jen had reduced her workload, she ended up being responsible for all of the household work, including running errands, paying bills, cooking, and scheduling. When the offer came from Mark and Priscilla, Jen wasn't sure she was ready to upset the current order by committing to a full-time job with frequent travel. I urged her to set up the relationship dynamic she wanted sooner rather than later. Jen remembers my suggesting, if you want an equal partnership, you should start now. Jen and Andy discussed the opportunity and decided she should take the job because of the impact she could have. And who would pick up the slack? Andy would. He rearranged his work so he could be home with the boys each morning and night, and even more when Jen travels. He now pays all the bills and squeezes in grocery runs as much as she does. He cooks and cleans more, knows the details of the schedule, and is happy to be the number one in-demand parent for half the week. A year and a half into this new arrangement, Andy told me that he loves his time alone with their boys and the increased role that he has in their lives. Jen loves her job and is glad that she and her husband now have a more equal marriage. My time is now as valuable as his, she told me. As a result, we are happier. Research supports Jen's observation that equality between partners leads to happier relationships. When husbands do more housework, wives are less depressed, marital conflicts decrease, and satisfaction rises. When women work outside the home and share breadwinning duties, couples are more likely to stay together. In fact, the risk of divorce reduces by about half when a wife earns half the income and a husband does half the housework. For men, participating in child rearing fosters the development of patience, empathy, and adaptability, characteristics that benefit all of their relationships. For women, earning money increases their decision-making ability in the home, protects them in case of divorce, and can be important security in later years, as women often outlive their husbands. Also, and many might find this the most motivating factor, couples who share domestic responsibilities have more sex. It may be counterintuitive, but the best way for a man to make a pass at his wife might be to do the dishes. I also feel strongly that when a mother stays at home, her time during the day should still be considered real work, because it is. Raising children is at least as stressful and demanding as a paying job. It is unfair that mothers are frequently expected to work long into the night while fathers who work outside the home get the chance to relax from their day jobs. When the father is home, he should take on half the childcare and housework. Also, most employed fathers interact with other grown-ups all day, while mothers at home are often starved for adult conversation by evening. I know a woman who gave up a career as a lawyer to be a stay-at-home mom and always insisted that when her husband, a TV writer, got home from work, he asked her, "How was your day?" before he launched into an account of his own. True partnership in our homes does more than just benefit couples today. It also sets the stage for the next generation. The workplace has evolved more than the home, in part because we enter it as adults, so each generation experiences a new dynamic. But the homes we create tend to be more rooted in our childhoods. My generation grew up watching our mothers do the childcare and housework while our fathers earned the wages. It's too easy for us to get stuck in these patterns. It is no surprise that married and cohabitating men whose mothers were employed while they were growing up do more housework as adults than other men. The sooner we break the cycle, the faster we will reach greater equality. One of the reasons Dave is a true partner is because he grew up in a home where his father set an extraordinary example. Sadly, Dave's father, Mel, passed away before I had a chance to meet him, but he clearly was a man way ahead of his time. Mel's mother worked side by side with her husband, running the family's small grocery store, so Mel grew up accepting women as equals, which was unusual in those days. As a single man, he became interested in the women's movement and read Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. He was the one who introduced his wife and Dave's mother, Paula, to this feminist wake-up call in the 1960s. He encouraged Paula to set up and lead PACER, a national nonprofit to help children with disabilities. A law professor, Mel often taught classes at night. Since he wanted the family to have at least one meal together each day, he decided it would be breakfast and prepared the meal himself, complete with fresh squeezed orange juice. A more equal division of labor between parents will model better behavior for the next generation. I have heard so many women say that they wished their partners helped more with childcare. But since it's only a few more years until their kids are off to school, it's not worth the battle to change the dynamic. In my opinion, it is always worth the battle to change an undesirable dynamic. I also worry that these women will face the same dynamic when it comes time to care for aging parents. Women provide more than twice as much care not only for their own parents, but for their in-laws as well. This is an additional burden that needs to be shared. And children need to see it being shared so that their generation will follow that example. In 2012, Gloria Steinem sat down in her home for an interview with Oprah Winfrey. Gloria reiterated that progress for women in the home has trailed progress in the workplace, explaining, "Now we know that women can do what men can do, but we don't know that men can do what women can do. I believe they can, and we should give them more chances to prove it. This revolution will happen one family at a time." The good news is that men in younger generations appear more eager to be real partners than men in previous generations. A survey that asked participants to rate the importance of various job characteristics found that men in their 40s most frequently selected work which challenges me as very important, while men in their 20s and 30s most frequently selected having a job with a schedule that allows me to spend time with my family. If these trends hold as this group ages, it could signal a promising shift. Wonderful, sensitive men of all ages are out there. And the more women value kindness and support in their boyfriends, the more men will demonstrate it. Christina Saland, my friend who devised the tests to screen her dates, told me that her son insists that when he grows up, he wants to take care of his children like daddy does. She and her husband were thrilled to hear this. More boys need that role model and that choice. As more women lean into their careers, more men need to lean into their families. We need to encourage men to be more ambitious in their homes. We need more men to sit at the table, the kitchen table. Chapter 9. The Myth of Doing It All. Having it all. Perhaps the greatest trap ever set for women was the coining of this phrase. Bandied about in speeches, headlines, and articles, these three little words are intended to be aspirational, but instead make all of us feel like we have fallen short. I have never met a woman, or man, who has stated emphatically, "Yes, I have it all." Because no matter what any of us has, and how grateful we are for what we have, no one has it all. Nor can we. The very concept of having it all flies in the face of the basic laws of economics and common sense. As Sharon Poxter, professor of economics at Cornell, explains, "The antiquated rhetoric of having it all disregards the basis of every economic relationship, the idea of trade-offs. All of us are dealing with the constrained optimization that is life, attempting to maximize our utility based on parameters like career, kids, relationships, etc., doing our best to allocate the resource of time. Due to the scarcity of this resource, therefore, none of us can have it all, and those who claim to are most likely lying." Having it all is best regarded as a myth. And like many myths, it can deliver a helpful cautionary message. Think of Icarus, who soared to great heights with his man-made wings. His father warned him not to fly too near the sun, but Icarus ignored the advice. He soared even higher. His wings melted, and he crashed to earth. Pursuing both a professional and personal life is a noble and attainable goal, up to a point. Women should learn from Icarus to aim for the sky, but keep in mind that we all have real limits. Instead of pondering the question, "Can we have it all?" we should be asking the more practical question, Can we do it all? And again, the answer is no. Each of us makes choices constantly between work and family, exercising and relaxing, making time for others, and taking time for ourselves. Being a parent means making adjustments, compromises, and sacrifices every day. For most people, sacrifices and hardships are not a choice, but a necessity. About 65% of married couple families with children in the United States have two parents in the workforce, with almost all relying on both incomes to support their household. Being a single working parent can be even more difficult. About 30% of families with children are led by a single parent, with 84% of those led by a woman. Mothers who work outside the home are constantly reminded of these challenges. Tina Fey noted that when she was promoting the movie Date Night with Steve Carell, a father of two and star of his own sitcom, reporters would grill Fey on how she balances her life, but never posed that question to her male co-star. As she wrote in Bossy Pants, "What is the rudest question you can ask a woman? How old are you? What do you weigh? When you and your twin sister are alone with Mr. Hefner, do you have to pretend to be lesbians? No, the worst question is, how do you juggle it all?" People constantly ask me, with an accusatory look in their eyes, "You're fucking it all up, aren't you?" their eyes say. Faye nails it. Employed mothers and fathers both struggle with multiple responsibilities, but mothers also have to endure the rude questions and accusatory looks that remind us that we're shortchanging both our jobs and our children. As if we needed reminding. Like me, most of the women I know do a great job worrying that we don't measure up. We compare our efforts at work to those of our colleagues, usually men, who typically have far fewer responsibilities at home. Then we compare our efforts at home to those mothers who dedicate themselves solely to their families. Outside observers reminding us that we must be struggling and failing is just bitter icing on an already soggy cake. Trying to do it all and expecting that it all can be done exactly right is a recipe for disappointment. Perfection is the enemy. Gloria Steinem said it best. You can't do it all. No one can have two full-time jobs, have perfect children, and cook three meals and be multi-orgasmic till dawn. Superwoman is the adversary of the women's movement. Dr. Lori Glimcher, Dean of Weill Cornell Medical College, said the key for her in pursuing her career while raising children was learning where to focus her attention. I had to decide what mattered and what didn't, and I learned to be a perfectionist in only the things that mattered. In her case, she concluded that scientific data had to be perfect, but reviews and other mundane administrative tasks could be considered good enough at 95%. Dr. Glimcher also said she made it a priority to get home at a reasonable hour, adding that when she got there, she refused to worry about whether the linens were folded or the closets were tidy. You can't be obsessive about these things that don't matter. A few years before I became a mother, I spoke on a women's panel for a local business group in Palo Alto. One of the other panelists, an executive with two children, was asked the inevitable question about how she balances her work and her children. She started her response by saying, "I probably shouldn't admit this publicly," and then she confessed that she put her children to sleep in their school clothes to save 15 precious minutes every morning. At the time, I thought to myself, yep, she should not have admitted that publicly. Now that I'm a parent, I think this woman was a genius. We all face limits of time and patience. I have not yet put my children to sleep in their school clothes, but there are mornings when I wish I had. I also know that all the planning in the world cannot prepare us for the constant challenges of parenting. In hindsight, I appreciate my fellow panelists' candor. And in the spirit of that candor, I probably shouldn't admit this publicly either. Last year, I was traveling with my children to a business conference. Several other Silicon Valley folks were attending too, and John Donahoe, the CEO of eBay, kindly offered us a ride on the eBay plane. When the flight was delayed for several hours, my main concern was keeping my kids occupied so they would not disturb the other adult passengers. I made it through the delay by allowing them to watch endless TV and eat endless snacks. Then, just as the flight finally took off, my daughter started scratching her head. "Mommy, my head itches," she announced loudly, speaking over the headset she was wearing, as she watched even more TV. I didn't think anything of it until her itching grew frantic and her complaints grew louder. I urged her to lower her voice, then examined her head and noticed small white things. I was pretty sure I knew what they were. I was the only person bringing young children on this corporate plane, and now my daughter most likely had lice. I spent the rest of the flight in a complete panic, trying to keep her isolated, her voice down, and her hands out of her hair, while I furiously scanned the web for pictures of lice. When we landed, everyone piled into rental cars to caravan to the conference hotel, but I told them to go ahead without me. I just needed to pick something up. I dashed to the nearest pharmacy, where they confirmed my diagnosis. Fortunately, we had avoided direct contact with anyone else on the plane, so there was no way for the lice to have spread, which saved me from the fatal embarrassment of having to tell the group to check their own heads. We grabbed the shampoo that I needed to treat her and, as it turned out, her brother, and spent the night in a marathon hair-washing session. I missed the opening night dinner, and when asked why, I said my kids were tired. Frankly, I was too. And even though I managed to escape the lice, I could not stop scratching my head for several days. It is impossible to control all the variables when it comes to parenting. For women who have achieved previous success by planning ahead and pushing themselves hard, this chaos can be difficult to accept. Psychologist Jennifer Stewart studied a group of Yale graduates and concluded that for such women, the effort to combine career and motherhood may be particularly fraught. The stakes are high, as they may expect nothing less than perfection, both at home and in the workplace. When they fall short of lofty ideals, they may retreat altogether, from workplace to home or vice versa. Another one of my favorite posters at Facebook declares in big red letters, "Done is better than perfect." I have tried to embrace this motto and let go of unattainable standards. Aiming for perfection causes frustration at best and paralysis at worst. I agree completely with the advice offered by Nora Ephron in her 1996 Wellesley commencement speech when she addressed the issue of women having both a career and family. Ephron insisted, "It will be a little messy, but embrace the mess. It will be complicated, but rejoice in the complications. It will not be anything like what you think it will be like, but surprises are good for you. And don't be frightened. You can always change your mind. I know. I've had 4 careers and 3 husbands." I was extremely fortunate that early in my career I was warned about the perils of trying to do it all by someone I deeply admired. Larry Kanarek managed the Washington, D.C. office of McKinsey & Company, where I interned in 1994. One day, Larry gathered everyone together for a talk. He explained that since he was running the office, employees came to him when they wanted to quit. Over time, he noticed that people quit for one reason only. They were burnt out, tired of working long hours and traveling. Larry said he could understand the complaint, but what he could not understand was that all the people who quit, every single one, had unused vacation time. Up until the day they left, they did everything McKinsey asked of them before deciding that it was too much. Larry implored us to exert more control over our careers. He said McKinsey would never stop making demands on our time, so it was up to us to decide what we were willing to do. It was our responsibility to draw the line. We needed to determine how many hours we were willing to work in a day and how many nights we were willing to travel. If later on the job did not work out, we would know that we had tried on our own terms. Counterintuitively, Long-term success at work often depends on not trying to meet every demand placed on us. The best way to make room for both life and career is to make choices deliberately, to set limits and stick to them. During my first 4 years at Google, I was in the office from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day at a minimum. I ran the global operations teams and thought it was critical that I stay on top of as many details as possible. No one ever demanded that I work this schedule. Typical of Silicon Valley, Google was not the type of place to set hours for anyone. Still, the culture in those early days promoted working around the clock. When my son arrived, I wanted to take the 3 months of maternity leave Google offered, but I worried that my job would not be there when I returned. Events leading up to his birth did not put my mind at ease. Google was growing quickly and reorganizing frequently. My team was one of the largest in the company, and coworkers often suggested ways to restructure, which usually meant that they would do more and I would do less. In the months before my leave, several colleagues, all men, ramped up these efforts, volunteering to help run things while I was gone. Some of them even mentioned to my boss that I might not return, so it made sense to start sharing my responsibilities immediately. I tried to take Larry Kanarek's advice and draw my own line. I decided that I wanted to focus entirely on my new role as a mother. I was determined to truly unplug. I even made this decision public, a trick that can help a commitment stick by creating greater accountability. I announced that I was going to take the full 3 months off. No one believed me. A group of my colleagues bet on how long I would be off email after giving birth, with not a single person taking more than 1 week as his or her wager. I would have been offended, except they knew me better than I knew myself. I was back on email from my hospital room the day after giving birth. Over the next 3 months, I was unable to unplug much at all. I checked email constantly. I organized meetings in my living room, during which I sometimes breastfed and probably freaked several people out. I tried to set these gatherings for times when my son would be sleeping, but babies make their own schedules. I went into the office for key meetings, baby in tow. And while I had some nice moments with my son, I look back on that maternity leave as a pretty unhappy time. Being a new mother was exhausting, and when my son slept, I worked instead of resting. And the only thing worse than everyone knowing that I was not sticking to my original commitment was that I knew it too. I was letting myself down. 3 months later, my non-leave maternity leave ended. I was returning to a job I loved, but as I pulled the car out of the driveway to head to the office for my first full day back, I felt a tightness in my chest and tears started to flow down my cheeks. Even though I had worked throughout my time off, I had done so almost entirely from home, with my son right next to me. Going back to the office meant a dramatic change in the amount of time I would see him. If I returned to my typical 12-hour days, I would leave the house before he woke up and return after he was asleep. In order to spend any time with him at all, I was going to have to make changes and stick to them. I started arriving at work around 9 a.m. and leaving at 5:30 p.m. This schedule allowed me to nurse my son before I left and get home in time to nurse again before putting him to sleep. I was scared that I would lose credibility, or even my entire job, if anyone knew that these were my new in-the-office hours. To compensate, I started checking emails around 5 a.m. Yep, I was awake before my newborn. Then, once he was down at night, I would jump back on my computer and continue my workday. I went to great lengths to hide my new schedule from most people. Camille, my ingenious executive assistant, came up with the idea of holding my first and last meetings of the day in other buildings to make it less transparent when I was actually arriving or departing. When I did leave directly from my office, I would pause in the lobby and survey the parking lot to find a colleague-free moment to bolt to my car. Given my awkwardness, we should all be relieved that I once worked for the Treasury Department and not the CIA. Looking back, I realized that my concern over my new hours stemmed from my own insecurity. Google was hard-charging and hyper-competitive, but it also supported combining work and parenthood, an attitude that clearly started at the top. Larry and Sergey came to my baby shower and each gave me a certificate that entitled me to 1 hour of babysitting. I never used the certificates, and if I could find them, I bet I could auction them off for charity, like lunch with Warren Buffett. Susan Wojcicki, who blazed a trail by having 4 children while being one of Google's earliest and most valuable employees, brought her children to the office when her babysitter was sick. Both my boss, Omid, and David Fisher, the most senior leader on my team, were steadfast supporters and did not allow others to take over parts of my job. Slowly, it began to dawn on me that my job did not really require that I spend 12 full hours a day in the office. I became much more efficient, more vigilant about only attending or setting up meetings that were truly necessary, more determined to maximize my output during every minute I spent away from home. I also started paying more attention to the working hours of those around me. Cutting unnecessary meetings saved time for them as well. I tried to focus on what really mattered. Long before I saw the poster, I began to adopt the mantra, "Done is better than perfect." Done, while still a challenge, turns out to be far more achievable and often a relief. By the time I took my 2nd maternity leave, I not only unplugged, mostly, but really enjoyed the time with both my children. My sister-in-law, Amy, a doctor, experienced almost the exact same evolution in attitude. When I had my 1st child, I worked 12-hour days while trying to pump at work, she told me. I wanted to feel connected to my baby in the limited hours that I was home, so I made myself her sole caregiver many nights. I believed that others were demanding this of me, my bosses at work and my daughter at home. But in truth, I was torturing myself. With the birth of her 2nd child, Amy adjusted her behavior. I took 3 months off and handled my return to work in my own way, on my own terms. And despite what I had previously feared, my reputation and productivity weren't hurt a bit. I deeply understand the fear of appearing to be putting our families above our careers. Mothers don't want to be perceived as less dedicated to their jobs than men or women without family responsibilities. We overwork to overcompensate. Even in workplaces that offer reduced or flex time arrangements, people fear that reducing their hours will jeopardize their career prospects. And this is not just a perception problem. Employees who make use of flexible work policies are often penalized and seen as less committed than their peers. And those penalties can be greater for mothers in professional jobs. This all needs to change, especially since new evidence suggests working from home might actually be more productive in certain cases. It is difficult to distinguish between the aspects of a job that are truly necessary and those that are not. Sometimes the situation is hard to read and the lines are hard to draw. Amy told me about a conference dinner she attended with a group of fellow physicians, including one who had given birth to her 1st child several weeks earlier. About 2 hours into the meal, the new mom was looking uncomfortable, glancing repeatedly at her cell phone. As a mother herself, Amy was sensitive to the situation. "Do you need to leave and pump?" she whispered to her colleague. The new mom sheepishly admitted that she had brought her baby and her mother to the conference. She was looking at her cell phone because her mother was texting her that the baby needed to be fed. Amy encouraged the new mom to leave immediately. Once she left, the young mother's mentor, an older male physician, admitted that he had no idea that she had brought her baby. If he had known, he would have encouraged her to leave earlier. She was torturing herself unnecessarily. This is one instance where I would have recommended not to sit at the table. Technology is also changing the emphasis on strict office hours, since so much work can be conducted online. While few companies can provide as much flexibility as Google and Facebook, other industries are starting to move in a similar direction. Still, the traditional practice of judging employees by face time rather than results unfortunately persists. Because of this, many employees focus on hours clocked in the office rather than on achieving their goals as efficiently as possible. A shift to focusing more on results